The Cycling Podcast, powered by Super Sapiens. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches.
Well, Richard, what was that very enthusiastic crowd noise? And tell me, where are you?
I am right now in the centre of Bruges, Lionel, at the in the fan zone at the World Championships. It's Monday, and we're in between the under 23 time trot and the women's time trot. And the noise that we opened with there, well, that was the sound of Remco Evenepoel finishing yesterday's men's time trial. He went into the hot seat. At the time, held on for third place to give Belgium, the home nation, silver and bronze, because Wout van Aert, of course, finished second. Filippo Ganna defended his title to become, again, the men's time trial champion. But, yeah, I'm here in Bruges at the World Championships, and it feels like, I guess, we expected the World Championships in Flanders to feel, in a way, pretty lively, pretty bustly, and quite international. You know, I can see, you can always see Norwegian flags, can't you? And there are a few Norwegian fans here, and a few from other countries too, though not as many as you would normally see at a World Championship. But it's a good atmosphere, and it was a great atmosphere yesterday for the men's time trial.
Well, it's the celebratory UCI World Championships, isn't it? Because it's the centenary of the first road World Championships, which were in, do you remember where? I mean, I'm not asking you.
I don't remember. No,
whether,
I wasn't
whether
there.
You were there in 1921.
I couldn't get accreditation for that one.
In Copenhagen, in Denmark, in 1921. No time trial then, of course, because it was just a road race, won by a Swedish rider, Gunnar Skald. And
who could forget?
Who can forget? Yes. And the, well, this is a celebratory World Championships in more ways than one, isn't it? Because it, watching on the TV, as I have done so far, Richard, the crowds look absolutely fantastic. And it does feel very uplifting. It is almost as if COVID never happened, because they were 6, 7, 10 deep in places. And the noise was coming through the TV very, very clearly. Obviously, Remco got cheered all the way round, and then so did Van Aert. And then there was an absolutely deathly silence when Filippo Ganna hit the line and denied Belgium the gold medal. I don't know whether that's me just projecting, or whether it did feel a little bit flat for the home fans when Ganna took gold.
Yeah, I think so. You know, I was actually asking some of our Belgian colleagues, who's more popular, Wout van Aert or Remco Evenepoel? Because Van Aert is the more accomplished, the older rider. Evenepoel's the great hope for the future, and he rides for a Belgian team, and I wondered if that made a difference. But I was told it was pretty unanimous that Van Aert is the more popular figure in Belgium. You know, Evenepoel is popular too, but Van Aert is sort of universally loved, whereas Evenepoel seems ever so slightly more divisive in a way. And I think the strength of support for Van Aert certainly came through yesterday. And yeah, I think the cyclocross as well makes a difference. So that's a kind of that's something that has gained Van Aert a big and very enthusiastic following over the years. I mean, just watching that podium, though, I think we're going to talk about the men's time trial, aren't we, in this first part, to see little Remco Evenepoel alongside these two giants, comparatively speaking, in Ganna and Van Aert. You were quite struck by, you know, just the sort of power he must put out to compete with those guys. He's so small in comparison. And as Daniel said a couple of weeks ago, he sort of speaks a language in cycling that he's not familiar with. Or he cycles in a language that he doesn't understand. And he's an unusual talent, isn't he, Evenepoel? Still so young, still and so slightly built. I was going to almost said still so slightly built, but so slightly built and so capable on these. And it was a pan-flat time trial course. It was a pure time trial effort. And you'd have thought it would favour, you know, big, powerful rulers like Ganna and Van Aert. But I thought Evenepoel's performance was arguably the sort of performance of the day.
Yeah, you mentioned how flat it was, Richard. The flattest time trial at the World Championships since Doha in Qatar in 2016. This course, there were only 78 metres of elevation in 43.3 kilometres. And it reminded me a little bit of a 3 days of Dapana time trial from back when that was a mini stage race and they would finish with the time trial on the final afternoon. The scenery and the fact that it started up on the coast and then headed through the countryside and finished in the very charming city of Bruges, which I'm sure you've been enjoying. I suppose they were hoping perhaps that the wind might blow, which would have made it a very different type of test, but that would have possibly tilted the favour even more strongly in favour of the big units, because they get carried along like sails if there's a tailwind, and they've got the pure punch and power if it's a head or cross headwind, I suppose.
Yeah.
But it was very still. You'll be able to tell me, Rich. It looked very still. People were saying it was very still.
Yeah, it was still yesterday. It's still today. It was quite breezy this morning, actually, but it's died down, and it looks perfectly still now for the women's time trial. Yeah, there were a few riders yesterday complaining a little bit about, you know, well, not complaining, but just observing that it hadn't been a course that suited them. Stefan Kung was one of them, who said that he, you know, much prefers climbs or, you know, undulations where it breaks the rhythm a bit and just allows him, as he put it, to punch through. I think Evenepoel as well would have preferred a slightly hillier course. And time trialists like Dumoulin, they prefer hillier courses. Roglic, I guess, as well. Ghana's just a pure time trialist, isn't it? And I guess the other takeaway is just, again, to underline the phenomenal ability of Van Aert in so many different areas of the sport, disciplines of the sport, because this was the sort of course that suited Ghana, the best time trialist in the world, down to the ground, and Van Aert really pushed them all the way, you know. And Van Aert's a guy who can win a Mont Ventoux, he can win a bunch sprint, he can do anything, can't he? And to get so close to Ghana on a course like this, again, just underlines his ability and the form that he's in. And he's had a lot of silver medals now in his career, and I'm sure a lot of people would not begrudge him a Road World title on Sunday when we've got the men's road race. But we'll be talking about that a bit later on, Lionel, won't we? We're going to hear from Kasper Asgreen, who will he'll be part of a very strong Danish team. We'll hear from Tim de Klerk as well on the men's road race. But that Danish team, which is very strong here in Bruges, has had a really unbelievable tragedy to contend with at the start of these World Championships. They got underway in a really sombre atmosphere because there was the awful news on Saturday evening of the death of Chris Anker Sørensen, the former rider who for the last couple of years has worked for Danish media, and he was here in Bruges to cover the World Championships for the Danish media. Went out on his bike on Saturday and was hit by a van and died, and it meant the World Championships got underway in a somber atmosphere. It was news and a tragedy that really rocked an awful lot of people, not just people in the Danish team, but he was a very popular figure, a very likeable guy as a rider and in post-career working in the media. Just a terribly sad thing to get your head around at the start of what should have been, or what's intended to be, a celebratory World Championships. And a reminder, I suppose. I mean, we often talk about Belgium as being, in theory at least, one of the safest places to ride your bike, because the infrastructure here for cycling is incredible. I went out on my bike this morning, and three quarters of the ride was on segregated cycling paths. But you only need one thing to go wrong with a vehicle, and you know, you're always at risk on a bike. And if somebody of Anker Sorensen's skill and experience can be killed while riding his bike, then really any of us can. And that was the stark reminder of his death, which is of no consolation to anybody whatsoever. And it's just an incredible sadness. And at the end of this episode, we'll hear from Brian Nygaard, who some of you will remember, or most of you remember, hopefully, from our Giro coverage. Brian worked with Chris Anker Sørensen for many years and knew him very well. So we'll hear from Brian on Chris Anker Sørensen at the end of the episode.
Yes, Richard, terribly sad news about Chris Anker Sorensen, a Giro d'Italia stage winner, of course, and a very aggressive rider in the mountains, sort of a pure climber, wasn't he? And, well, the World Championships went on today with the under-23 men's time trial, and there was a Danish winner, Johan Price-Petersen. And I'm sure that before the men's road race and perhaps some of the other races over the weekend, the Danish riders and the whole peloton will pay tribute to Chris Anker Sorensen.
And Price-Petersen was very emotional at the finish, and he explained afterwards in his press conference that, you know, Anker Sorensen was very much in his thoughts. And something that Kasper Asgreen said yesterday as well, that when he was suffering out there in the time trial, he was thinking of him and trying to dig a bit deeper in his memory, if you like. And I don't know, people might remember as well, we didn't have an under 23 or junior world titles last year, of course. 2 years ago, the last under 23 time trial in Harrogate, you remember that Price-Petersen was the rider who was kind of, I don't know how to put it, he came off spectacularly in the time trial when he rode into what he thought was shallow standing water, and it turned into almost a lake in the middle of the road. Do you remember that? There's incredible video footage of his bike being kind of swept away. And well, he made up for that today by winning the time trial here. And it carries on an incredible run by the Danes, because Mikael Bjerg won three titles in a row of the under 23 title, and Johan Price-Petersen continues that run.
The Cycling Podcast, powered by Super Sapiens. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches. And now you can wear the Super Sapiens Energy Band, the first and only wearable that can display real-time glucose data directly from Abbott's LibreSense Glucose Sport Biosensor. The Super Sapiens Energy Band is available at supersapiens.com for €159.
Thank you very much indeed to our title sponsor, Super Sapiens. Very grateful to them for their support. And if you'd like to know more about Super Sapien, how Super Sapiens can help you, if you're an athlete or a coach, go to supersapiens.com. Now, Lionel, I know you were studying the time trial intently. I mean, it was, you know, we talk about being in a sort of golden age of cycling talent at the moment, don't we? And that applies in time trialing too, I think. And it was a real ding-dong between Van Aert and Ganna, and a pretty thrilling finale to the time trial, I thought, with those two being so close, the last two riders off, and it really coming down to a race between them.
Yeah, it was a showdown between the pair of them, but I thought it was a really interesting time trial, the way it unfolded. I know sometimes I'm a little bit down on time trialing as a television spectacle, but I do like a championship time trial where everything is on the line. You know, the gold, silver and bronze medals are on the line. I think perhaps in Grand Tours sometimes there's a risk with particularly long time trials that they can do so much damage in the general classification that you end up feeling a little bit flat at the end of the day, thinking, well, that has completely altered the shape of the race. Whereas when it is just a championship, it's an absorbing watch. And I particularly enjoyed the fact that Evenepoel had the hot seat for so much of the afternoon as some really good time trialists came in and didn't topple his time. I mean, if we just go back to the start of the early starters, an Italian rider, Matteo Sobrero, set the fastest time. And then Dan Bigham of Great Britain went faster, but he didn't. I don't think he even got to sit in the hot seat. He may well have done, but his backside possibly only rested on the luxurious plastic chair for a few seconds before Max Walscheid came in. He was the next finisher, and then Stefan Bissiger, who I thought was an outside shot for a medal, he took the lead. And before he knew it, Evenepoel came in, and Evenepoel really blew Bissiger's time away, didn't he? 42 seconds quicker. And then we saw the old man, Tony Martin, who we'll talk about in the end of this part, because he announced his retirement on the eve of the championships, or confirmed his retirement at the end of the season. Tony Martin came in second place behind Evenepoel. Kasper Asgreen of Denmark then pushed Martin down a place. And then it was all about the big two, because, as you said, Stefan Kung didn't excel on this kind of course. And Well, did Wout van Aert go out a bit too quick? He was, I think, about 7 or 8 seconds up on Ganna at the first checkpoint, and then they were split by only 0.84 of a second at the second checkpoint, but van Aert was still narrowly ahead. But it was obvious that Ganna had, you know, judged the effort and had a bit more in the tank over the latter stages of the course. And when he hit the line, you know, it was Ganna had time as he came into the finishing straight to clock that he had won, and he had time to take his hands off the bars and punch the air. But it was close, wasn't it? Only 6 seconds, and a real nip and tuck battle between two obviously very good time trialists. But perhaps on that flat course, it was the pure specialism of Filippo Ganna that told over Wout van Aert, who obviously no slouch against the clock, but you know, perhaps even more of an all-round rider than Ganna.
Yeah, I was surprised that Ganna was so confident to punch the air like that. But, you know, van Aert did go through that first check quickest, and then Ganna was sort of closing all the time, and he judged it perfectly. And he said it afterwards, actually, that he had really quite consciously eased off on the power, as he put it, at the start. It was quite technical at the start, and he wanted to ride into it. You know, he is the best time trialist in the world. I think there's no question about that. But he's not been completely dominant, has he? He's had a few upsets and disappointments. I think a lot of us would have maybe put the Olympic time trial down as one of those. Although he said that he wouldn't have, that his priority in Tokyo was the team pursuit, and he wouldn't have actually even ridden the time trial in Tokyo had he not won the world time trial in Imola last year. So I don't know, but he obviously felt that in Tokyo, it was a slightly compromised effort in the time trial. Here he was at his best. And, you know, at his best, he's just that little bit better than everybody else, I guess. And especially on a course like this. But yeah, Van Aert went close, and he's gone close to a lot of titles recently. And like I said, he's got a decent chance, I would have thought a very decent chance on Sunday of getting that. The rainbow jersey of world champion in the road race. You mentioned Tony Martin, Lionel. A really strong performance from him in his last time trial, and his second last race, because he'll actually finish after Wednesday's mixed time trial. That'll be the end of his career. And he's, in order to retire at this point, he's actually broken his contract with Jumbo-Visma, but he said that they have been supportive of that. He's brought the curtain down a bit early because a big factor seems to be the crashes that he's had. I mean, we all remember the crash at the Tour de France on day one, when he hit the sign being held out by that lady and took down his entire team, suffered nasty injuries in that. But he's had a lot of nasty crashes over recent years. But just on his record in the time trial, 13 rides in the individual time trial, and is the lowest result, 9th place. Pretty phenomenal. He won four world titles in his career. I think we're going to hear from Tony Martin in a moment, because he's not always the easiest guy to interview. I did write about this in our book a couple of years ago, when I found myself about a foot away from him at the finish of a Vuelta stage, and he almost came to a halt actually on my foot, and it seemed the natural thing to ask him for an interview, and he refused. Not only did he refuse, but he refused to make eye contact as well. So that was an awkward moment. But he was in a more relaxed mood at the finish of the time trial. And he spoke at some length there about his bringing the curtain down on his career and his thoughts at the end of a long and very successful career.
Well, before we hear from Tony Martin, Rich, I was looking back at his career because it really is, on the one hand, some very high-profile wins, and on the other, some really high-profile and quite spectacular crashes. And he's 36 years old now, and as you say, four-time world time trial champion, and he's absolutely dominated the German time trial championships, including a run of 10 wins in a row. And he's a five-time Tour de France stage winner as well. But an interesting character, and somebody it'd be good to catch up with when perhaps he's retired and wants to look back on his career. He might look you in the eye and actually, you know, engage in conversation, Rich. I don't know. But he was born in East Germany in 1985, before the Berlin Wall came down. And one of the things that intrigues me about him and would like to know more about is that his family escaped East Germany not long before the wall came down. They did actually then move back into the eastern part of Germany after unification. And he actually went to the Erfurt Sports School, which is the same one that Marcel Kittel later went to. And that's where he sort of began his education as a cyclist. And he turned pro for High Road, rode for them initially, and then did 5 years with Omega Pharma Quickstep. And then a couple of seasons at Katusha, where really he looked a bit like a square peg in a round hole, didn't really have a sort of clearly defined role. But that's certainly something that he found at Jumbo-Visma, where he became a sort of road captain figure. And so we'll remember him, I guess, as not only a world-class time trial rider, but also a winner of week-long stage races. He won Paris-Nice back in 2011. He won the Eneco Tour, three tours of Belgium, and was an excellent climber and very, very strong in the breakaways. If you think back to his first Tour de France in 2009, he finished second to Juan Margarate on the Mont Ventoux stage right at the very end of that tour.
Just add to that line. I remember Brian Holm also saying that he could have ridden and won Paris-Roubaix in his career. He was always sort of trying to get him to do that. He never did focus on that, but he did different things at different points. He looked like he might be turning himself into a stage racer around the time of that Paris-Nice win, and then latterly, you know, he became that sort of almost Tim de Klerk like figure for Jumbo-Visma, the rider who'd be on the front for so long. It does put Rohan Dennis's recent signing in a fresh light, doesn't it? Because he would seem to be, perhaps physically at least, a replacement for Tony Martin.
Yeah, especially when you think of the way that Dennis rode in the Giro with Theo Gegenhardt last year, because one of the outstanding rides of Martin's career was in 2014. Do you remember the stage to Mulhouse, which went over all the climbs in the Vosges, including the Grand Ballon, I think it was? And he was away solo for 60 kilometres after dropping everyone else in the break, the last man with him was Alessandro De Marchi, I think. That was an outstanding stage win. He held the yellow jersey in 2015 after winning the Paris-Roubaix-style stage, didn't he? The cobbled stage to Cambrai, and was in yellow when a couple of days later he crashed very heavily in the final kilometre of a really hectic finish and broke his collarbone into several pieces and had to pull out of the race. And even in 2016, you know, some interesting ends to his tour. 2016, he made it all the way to the Champs-Élysées, but pulled out when they reached the team buses because he was experiencing severe knee pain, which had come on the previous day in the Alps. I guess he had his eye on the Olympic time trial in Rio, where he was 12th. And then in 2019, remember, he was disqualified from the tour along with Luke Rowe after they had that clash of road captains on the road to Gap, it was, wasn't it? A boiling hot day when temperatures were heated in more than one way. But he, yeah, perhaps that day took his role as the enforcer in Jumbo-Visma a little bit too seriously. But he did become very much a part of that team's engine room. And I suppose the way his tour ended this year, you know, he crashed on the stage to Mont Ventoux and pulled out of the race, but he'd also been brought down in that incident, as you said, Richard, crashing into the sign that was held right out into the middle of the road. And it is interesting that he's has cited the danger in the peloton as one of the reasons. So let's hear your chat with Tony Martin, recorded after yesterday's time trial, where he finished sixth, by the way.
How important was it to you to go out and end your career as a time trialist with such a strong performance today?
It was really, really, really important. I'm really happy that my team supported me to end my career here in the World Championships. It was always my favorite race, and in the world I always had my biggest victories, and so the circle closed here, and I'm really happy to end my career in this great atmosphere, even when I couldn't go for the medals. I'm still proud that I could be there with the best, not the really best, but I was still close, and So I'm satisfied, and I really enjoyed it the way I did it. And yeah, now we go for the last fight on Wednesday. I hope there will be more possible. From then on, I will enjoy professional cycling from the side, but also nice. I'm really looking forward to it, and looking also forward to the new things that will come. So I'm really curious how the second part of my life will be.
When did you make the decision? Was it a gradual thing, or was there any particular moment? You mentioned crashes, and you've had a lot of terrible crashes recently, but was there a particular moment?
Yeah. Actually, I made a decision a few days after my bad crash in the Tour de France that caused me to quit the tour. I had this thought in my head, but I still gave me some time to really think about it. But after a few weeks, thoughts were still in my head, and somehow it felt right. And I spoke to my family, to my friends, to my team, and they all supported me 100%. And I made this decision, and for the moment, until there, I never regret it. And especially, I'm really happy that the team supported me in this way, and that they gave me the chance to end my career as I wished. And for me, it's really the perfect surrounding here. It feels really good, and doesn't matter which result I did today. It's just nice to be here with the fans, with my closest people, and to say goodbye here in Belgium.
Can you pick out one performance or result from your career that is of a special important satisfaction to you?
Yeah, when I'm asked for my biggest victory, actually the World Championships in Copenhagen 10 years ago comes directly in my head. It was actually my breakthrough, my biggest result until there, and I think this feeling I will remember my whole life. And for me, I would say it's the nicest and most emotional victory.
I think you'll be emotional on Wednesday. Or are you emotional now?
Yeah, I always already told everybody. Mostly I realized the big results, the big victories, also the most important decisions after a few days when I'm alone, when I have time to think about it. I think then I will get a bit more emotional, but I think it will be when I'm alone and not here. I hope so.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind us to tell you that this episode is sponsored by our very good friends at Curators of Craft, and you can find out more about them at curatorsofcraft.co.uk. And stand by, because there's also an offer for listeners too. Curators of Craft was founded by Graham and Kate, who are both avid cyclists, big cycling fans, and fans of the cycling podcast. And one of the things they love about travel is sampling the food and beverages that different countries have to offer. And their passion for craft beer began in 2014 after a trip to North America and Europe. And they started the business late last year after Graham lost his job because of the COVID pandemic. And they very quickly made it their business to curate the best small batch beers, craft beers and Trappist ales from independent brewers in the UK, Europe, Scandinavia and the US. And they're very selective too. They very kindly sent me a box, and it would have been remiss of me this week not to have started with the two beers that span Flanders, one from the east, Westmalle, and one from the west, Roddenback. And I particularly enjoyed the Westmalle Trappist Extra. Now, I like the Westmalle Double and Triple beers, but they are really quite punchy, and this is considerably lighter at just 4.8%, but it loses none of the depth of flavour. So that's one to really look out for, the Westmalle Trappist Extra. Or how about the Rodenbach, which is from a brewery in Ruisselare, where there is a very fine cycling museum, and it's also where the Doise d'Or Vlaanderen one-day race starts. So the Rodenbach is a, well, it's complex and fruity, quite typical of a Flandrian beer, and yeah, you'll get a sort of a fruity, woody, vanilla-y, almost caramel flavour in the finish of the palate. It's not just Flandrian beers. These are the ones that I've been enjoying while the World Championships have been on, but the selections come from all across North America, Scandinavia, Europe and the UK. And you can either pick your own beers or you can trust Graham and Kate to curate a box for you. And I recommend you do that. And once you've placed an order, you can even open a monthly subscription and get regular deliveries. So go to curatorsofcraft.co.uk to see what they have to offer. And there is currently 15% off all orders over £40 for our listeners and free UK mainland delivery on all orders over £60. But you need to use the code WORLDS15. That's WORLDS15, the numbers 1 and 5. Go to curatorsofcraft.co.uk or check them out on social media.
Well, Lionel, we're deep into the episode, but there has been other stuff going on apart from the World Championship time trials. Have you got a little news roundup for us, please?
Well, I'll try to keep it a little, Rich, but there's been so much racing going on, hasn't there? I will try and recap it as tightly as I possibly can. First of all, just a bit of transfer news, because it does now look like Miguel Ángel López is going to go back to Astana, and the will-he-won't-he saga of Mark Cavendish extending his stay with De Koninck Quickstep seems to have been ironed out. It looks like he struck an agreement with Patrick Lefebvre after Lefebvre kind of gave the indication in the Belgian media that they were a little way apart in terms of valuation. But the racing...
Yeah, let's keep our eyes on that one, though, I think. We'll maybe try and speak to Mark Cavendish later in the week, but I'm pretty sure nothing's been agreed yet. And, you know, we've only got Lefebvre's word on that at the moment. So
Wow. Let's
keep an eye on it. Lefebvre was speaking to Daniel this morning. Daniel is here working for the BBC. Lefebvre went on Belgian TV last night and was allegedly slightly the worse for wear. You see it trending on Twitter is Lefebvre dronken, which I don't speak Flemish, but I think that means he had a couple of glasses of wine on Belgian telly last night.
Well, yes, I remember interviewing him in Spain after he had clearly had quite a big night. That episode went out. God, it feels like a lifetime ago now, but it was before COVID. But yeah, De Koninck Quickstep have had a pretty good week. Maybe that explains it. I think they won 7 races across the week. Joao Almeida won the Tour of Luxembourg ahead of Mark Hirschi and his own teammate Matteo Cattaneo. Almeida, Hirschi, Sascha Modolo, and David Godu won stages there. Cattaneo won the time trial. There was the Tour of Slovakia. Now, I don't know whether this indicates anything for the weekend, but Peter Sagan won his home tour for the first time in his career. And yet more De Koninck Quickstep success in the form of stage wins for Alvaro Hodge and Yannick Stiemler. Itamar Einhorn, the sprinter with Israel Startup Nation, who Daniel spoke to during the Vuelta, won a stage there too. And then it's a case of World Championship warm-up races, really, of various different types. In Italy, they have this run of one-day races, don't they, leading towards the Worlds. And Michael Valgren of EF Education Nippo won a couple of them, the Giro della Toscana and Coppa Sabatini. He took both of those. They're his first victories since the 2018 Amstel Gold Race. The Memorial Marco Pantani in Cesenatico, Pantani's hometown, of course, was won by the newly crowned European champion Sonny Colbrelli. He's looking good at going into the weekend's road race, because he was also second to Valgren at the Coppa Sabatini. And on Sunday, while all eyes were on the time trial there in Belgium, Matteo Trentin won the Trofeo Matteotti. So we'll pick some hints and tips as to who's going well ahead of the weekend from those races. Meanwhile, in Belgium, leading up to the World Championships. The Grand Prix de Wallonie was won by Christophe Laporte of Cofidis. The Championship Van Vlaanderen was won by Jasper Philipsen, who then added the Eschborn-Frankfurt World Tour race in Germany ahead of John Degenkolb and Alexander Christophe. Florian Seneschal, another De Koninck Quick-Step rider, won the Classic Impanis van Petegem. And Fabio Jakobsen, of course, Seneschal's teammate, won Greek's Appeal. So he's, the pair of them who were contesting the wins, going, well, helping one another and then going up against one another in the Vuelta. They've both won races. And lastly, the Grand Prix Isberge in northern France, won by Elia Viviani of Cofidis. And just a quick word for Leo Hayter, the younger brother of Ethan Hayter, who was eighth in the World Championship time trial for Great Britain. Leo Hayter won the under-23 Liège-Bastogne-Liège at the weekend, a very prestigious race for under-23s and a pretty reliable indicator of future success, really.
Yes, I spoke to Ethan Hayter after the finish of the time trial yesterday, and he was obviously cock-a-hoop at his brother's success. He said, and I've read a bit about this, that Leo Hayter's had a tough time throughout the last couple of years, the COVID years, with not racing and really feeling like he was stuck, I think, in common with a lot of younger riders especially who've just not had the racing. I mean, I was looking at some of the, you know, we always turn to pro cycling stats, don't we, to see what riders have been up to, especially under 23 riders, and so many of these guys have just not raced or barely raced at all the last couple of years, and it's even worse in the junior ranks. So I think he has found himself feeling very uncertain about his cycling career, Leo Hayter, and that's a huge, huge win for him. A couple of other odds and sods from the time trial yesterday, Lionel. I caught up with a couple of interesting people who we've had on the podcast in the past. The first of them, Marcus Christie. Friends of the podcast will know Marcus Christie's story. Daniel spent a lot of time really getting to know Marcus, an Irish rider who's had some incredible ups and downs and near misses in his career. And we released a special for Friends of the Podcast earlier this year, which had an amazing response from people, mainly people who didn't know who Marcus Christie was, and they were completely captivated by his story. And I guess him riding here the time trial on Bradley Wiggins' old bike, which is part of the story that he tells in that Friends special. It kind of it's the latest extraordinary chapter in his story, and if anybody, well, those of you familiar with his story will I'm sure be keen to find out what happened next with him. So I caught up with him at the finish of the time trial yesterday. How is it to be here, and how did that go?
Yeah, it's a fantastic experience to be here first and foremost, and the atmosphere is unbelievable. The first 20 minutes I think I settled in there quite well and was right on pace, and then it started biting a bit, and maybe I was like 5-10% low below where I should normally be, but I dug in and kept it going, and I think I have to be happy with the ride, all things considered. At the halfway point I did lose the radio, so the back end of the final I was a bit unsure about a few bends, so looking back I've messed up a bit there, but I mean, again, I have to be happy, I think.
And I mean, we sort of left your story, I guess, in the spring with the comeback, and you were being coached by Shane Sutton at the time. Are you still being coached by Shane?
Yeah. I mean, if I hadn't met Shane back then, I wouldn't be here today, to be honest. So I owe him a lot. He's been a tremendous help, and he's a great guy, really. And yeah, it's been a whirlwind since we've done that podcast, and it kind of just really did spark the fire once again for cycling. So. It's a funny story.
Is that how you feel? I mean, have you? Because we know your story in the past. You've had lots of problems and difficulties. Have you felt this year? Have you found a kind of a balance? And have you? You know, is that obviously you're here, so you've had a successful year. But have you found that kind of equilibrium, I suppose?
Yeah, big time. I think doing the podcast was like it really helped me just getting the story out there, and a lot of people got to know me through the podcast, and again, like, Shane kind of has helped me as much mentally as physically, and it just goes to show that in this sport you need to be mentally switched on as well as physically switched on, and It's the balance has definitely been better than it's ever been, and I'm enjoying cycling, which is the main thing.
Do you think about, you know, what might have been had you found that earlier in your career, or can you not really afford to think like that?
Yeah, I mean, it held me back for all those years. I mean, in hindsight, it would have been, I mean, if I'd have met somebody like Shane when I was 18, 19, it would be interesting to see where I'd be right now, like, but that's hindsight, and you can't really live in the past too much, so just got to focus on the future.
What's next then, Marcus? You were talking about our records, and, you know, what are your kind of ambitions next year and beyond?
I need to sit down and, like, recalibrate after this and see where I'm going to go, but possibly, should do the Irish Nationals at the end of the month and then take it from there.
Well, Richard, some people may be raising their eyebrows at the mention of Shane Sutton there, a very divisive figure, one who left British cycling in controversial circumstances, and certainly no angel, not someone who everyone gets on with. But I do think that clearly riders who do get on with Shane Sutton and find that his methods work, they really do work, but he's not for everyone.
No, but Marcus Christie credits him with kind of saving his career. So, like I say, the latest incredible chapter in his story, and if you want to hear the rest of his story, that episode is available to friends of the podcast. Supersonic, it's called, isn't it? It's a great listen. Somebody else, another divisive figure, that's a joke, Dan Bigham. He sort of raised the idea that some people do regard him as a divisive figure because he, of course, is probably as well known for his engineering and aerodynamic expertise as for his athletic ability. But he rode the time trial yesterday for Great Britain and put in a very, very good performance indeed. I think he was 16th in the end. And again, if you look at his diet of races and the sorts of riders he finished among, it is quite a phenomenal achievement. He rides for Ribble Weltcup, but he has worked with a lot of top teams. He worked with the Danish team as well for the Olympic Games, helping them with aerodynamics and so on. And like I say, his expertise in that area perhaps overshadows his abilities as a cyclist. And, at 29, there's a lot he can probably still do on a bike. And I think he's very ambitious over the next few years. A lot of people surprised, as we'll hear in this interview, to see him in a Great Britain shirt as well, because he's been quite critical of some of the selections made by the British team over the last couple of years. But here he is riding for Great Britain, or here he was riding for Great Britain, and here's what he had to say at the finish.
Hard, definitely hard. Mentally more than anything, especially that final third, just unrelenting around the entire course. And yeah, the final third, I kind of struggled, and I think that's a bit frustrating because I was up on Max at the second time check, and I think if I could have held back to the line, then I think I'd be sitting somewhere like second or third now, which would be pretty sweet. But yeah, I can't really complain. I think I got it all out of the tank. It was just, the better guys out there on the day.
You're physically okay, Dan, because you obviously didn't finish the Tour of Britain with a little injury concern. How are you now?
Yeah, so I mean, I've had that injury since I was knocked off by a car late 2015. So I've got two bulging discs in my back, and I just have to be super careful not to do stupid things, and crashing into a bush at 50k an hour is probably on a stupid things list. I just had to make do as I could throughout Tour of Britain, and that final breakaway stage five it finished me off. I was struggling to stand up, to be honest. But to be completely honest, on the TT bike does not affect me whatsoever, which is great. So it means I can train on that, no stress. I cannot complain about one single bit about my run into this, and I feel like I did myself justice. And I mean, in my head, I wanted to try and get a top 10. I felt like that was achievable. Looking at who's still to come, probably unlikely. I think I'm probably going to be somewhere like sort of 12th, 13th, 14th. We'll wait and see how it goes with that last group of hitters. But I don't think that's a bad thing. First World Championships, and hopefully I can keep progressing as an athlete. It's my first ever UCI time trial, so still lots to learn. Yeah, I always enjoy doing it. It's something I've always said, that like, I want to recognise as being a British athlete, and that, okay, I've not been able to represent on the track as much as I felt I was capable of doing, for a multitude of different reasons that aren't really worth going into. But on the road side, I think I've been well received, and I get on really well with Bramier, the men's road captain, and he's been top-notch, cannot fault him one bit. So I met him about 12 months ago when we were finally allowed out to go meet people, and just had a good proper chat of what's going to take for me to ride at Euros, at Worlds, at Com Games, at possibly even the Olympics. What does that look like from a execution perspective? What do I need power-wise, aero-wise, race result-wise? Who have we got to race against? Who have we got to beat? Literally answered every single question and has been great. So, thoroughly enjoyed being a British rider and felt really welcome. And I do get on with everyone. I think I'm not going to blame you guys. Obviously, the media like a story, and I'm always happy to wear my heart on my sleeve and tell you how I feel it is. I'll be completely honest. I've disagreed with selections and with criteria and stuff before, but I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing to be vocal about that, and I think that gets fed back and the system continues to improve, because if you're not open about those things and you're not critical, then who's to say they even know that's a problem? And I'd encourage all athletes that no matter what sport you're in and where you are as a standing, if you don't believe something's correct or right, then stand up for yourself, because people do listen. They want the system to improve. Like, BC aren't this big, like, evil corporation that sometimes they're made out to be. They're there to support British cycling, and they don't all know the answers, and they're willing to learn. And yeah, it's been great that they've been so open.
Well, before we move on from the time trial, Richard, it did strike me how, as an event, it does seem to lend itself to riders repeating victory. This was Philippe Ogana's second in a row. Rowan Dennis won two in a row before that. Tony Martin, of course, won three in a row. Cancellara won four in 5 years, and Mick Rogers won three in a row. But it did make me wonder whether, after all our talk about the Tour of Britain being tailor-made for Wout van Aert, and what was it we said, how to van Aert-proof stage race. Well, maybe we have the answer. Just make a race pan flat. We actually had a couple of amusing tweets from listeners. Paul Nicholson said, for something that can be done to stop Van Aert, make it Wouter-proof. So I certainly thought the time trial course was just about Wouter-proofed yesterday. The other comment we had in was, could we describe a stage race that is specifically designed to showcase the strength of the current Belgian champion to be described as Van Artisan? That was from Malcolm Wake. Yes, very good, very good.
Oh, nice.
And,
yeah.
And just lastly, history buffs who might be wondering, well, hang on, the UCI World Championships may well be celebrating their centenary, but wasn't the first world professional road race champion Alfredo Binder in 1927, which even my math will tell you isn't quite 100 years ago. That is right, yes. The first world pro road race was in 1927 at the Nürburgring in Germany, won by Alfredo Binder. But the first UCI World Road Race Championships, which was for amateurs only, was in 1921. So there we go.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport. Fueled by science.
Thanks very much indeed to Science and Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. If you would like 25% off all your Science and Sport products, go to scienceandsport.com and at the checkout enter the code SISCP25. Science and Sport support all our podcasts here at the Cycling Podcast, and we've got a very busy week, haven't we, Lionel? We've got the Cycling Podcast Femina is coming out tomorrow with the news and reaction from today's women's time trial, which is about to get underway. Big crowds actually gathering here. I mentioned the international nature of those. There are some Danes and some Swiss in front of me here waving their flags.
Oh, the Swiss. Yeah, the Swiss, big travellers, aren't they? Have they got huge cowbells as well, normally?
No, but they'll be here for, around. I guess, they'll be the Marlon Rooser Supporters Club. And they've got a big interest in this women's time trial this afternoon. I would say she's probably the favourite for that. So they'll be supporting her, I've no doubt. We've also got an episode of Service Course coming out later this week, Lizzie Banks and Tom Wally. And Life in the Peloton returns with Mitch Docker in conversation with Hannah Barnes, who is joining a Norwegian team. You know, X next year, isn't she? She's moving on from Canyon SRAM. Lionel, we're going to look ahead to the road races at the weekend. We've got a day off on Thursday here at the World Championships, and then the Junior Under 23 women's and men's road races at the weekend. We'll be looking forward to the women's road race in Femina tomorrow, but a really intriguing men's road race in prospect on a course, here we are in Flanders, but it's a course that doesn't really have too many echoes with too many of the very many races that there are here. I mean, Flèche Brabançon or Brabantse Pale is the one that's mentioned most regularly. I'm actually doing a ride on Thursday around the two circuits, so I'll be riding all of the climbs that they'll be tackling on Sunday, so I'll have a bit more insight into it after that. But it's a race that, well, we're going to hear from Kasper Asgreen in a moment, who'll be part of a very strong Danish team. He doesn't think it's going to be as hard as a Tour of Flanders. And so the race is, it could be quite an open race. And, you know, we look at the strong teams, certainly the Belgians, the Danish and the Italians. And Sonny Colbrelli has to be a strong contender. But I've even seen Caleb Ewan mention himself as an outsider to win, which suggests that, you could get quite a big group coming to the finish.
Yeah, it could be really interesting. It could be, well, anything could happen. This is what I enjoy about the World Championship Road Race, when it's on one of these courses that you can't quite tell in advance how it's going to play out. Obviously, the distance is a big factor, but if there's no sort of real set-piece, repetitive, serious climb, as we have seen in recent editions, anything could happen. If Caleb Ewan is lining up alongside Tadej Pogacar, Wout van Aert, Julian Alaphilippe, Matthew van der Poel, Primoz Roglic, Sonny Colbrelli, it just shows you that the race could either come down to some kind of sprint, or it will be a showdown between, the three wonders of the world. That's van Aert, van der Poel and Alaphilippe, plus the stage racers, Pogacar and Roglic. Or it could be one of those ones where we're all left scratching our heads at the end and wondering, well, how did they let that happen? A sort of, thinking back to 1999 and Oscar Freire's first World Championship win, where he just clipped off the front and no one went with him. That's the beauty of the World Championships. I know lots of people like to see the rainbow jersey on the shoulders of a rider that can genuinely be considered one of the sort of moving monuments of the peloton. And in the current case, that is Julian Alaphilippe, the defending champion, wore the rainbow jersey with, an awful lot of clout, hasn't he? You would never say anything other than he's one of the finest riders in the world. But yeah, it's going to be, I think, a tactically intriguing and interesting race. And you mentioned the Danes, Richard. Their lineup looks on paper to be extremely strong, particularly given that they have Kasper Asgreen, the Tour of Flanders winner, Magnus Cort, who of course was on fire at the Vuelta, and Michael Valgren, who on a course like this could well be a rider to watch, especially when those attacks start going and there's the reluctance to bring things back together.
Not to mention Mads Pedersen, the world champion 2 years ago, and I would also say Mikael Honoré has been riding really well the last few weeks as well. They've got a really, really strong team and no obvious leader. Several guys who can win there. And it was really interesting speaking to Kasper Asgreen at the finish yesterday. We'll hear from him now. But, he rides for De Koninck Quickstep, and he said that he would like the team to ride in the way that they do, with numbers rather than an out-and-out leader, and to ride in a very attacking way as well. Again, I think just copying the style of racing that gets De Koninck Quickstep so many wins. Let's hear what Kasper Asgreen, who'll be part of that Danish team, had to say at the finish yesterday about the world's road race this Sunday.
I think we have several cards to play. Our biggest competitors are for sure going to be the Belgians and the Italians. They have really, really strong collective squads as well. There's a lot of good riders spread out over the other nations. But I think the big nations are us, Belgium and Italy, and which also means we have to take some responsibility for the race, which we are prepared to do. So, I expect a fun race and a hard race on Sunday. Compared to Flanders, I would say it's not as hard as Flanders. if we had more laps around Overijse, I would say it would probably have been as hard as Flanders, but because we only have two laps there, and one of them is quite early in the race, I think it's going to be less hard. I think the weather is going to play a big role. If it's raining, the lap up in Leuven is going to be super hard because of all the corners through the city. That's really going to line up the bunch and can easily make some gaps. So yeah, I think the weather is going to be a huge factor and something we have to follow very closely in the coming week. We have a very flat hierarchy. As a starting point, we have five guys with three roles, and nobody has a clear leadership like Belgium, for example. So I think we're gonna try to employ a bit of a quick step tactic and just to try to play on our numbers and hope we have a good situation with more riders than the other nations.
Well, that was Casper Askren, Lionel, and I wouldn't like to be in the position of coach of the Danish team in a way, because they have got all these riders on form. How on earth do you decide which should be protected? How the tactics should play out to favour these all very different but also quite similar riders? I mean, Askren's just super strong. You know, fourth in the time trial yesterday. Winner of the Tour of Flanders this year. Magnus Cort is a pretty fast finisher. Michael Valgren's in red hot form, and he can sort of he can finish it off. I mean, he beat Sonny Colbrelli at the weekend there, or just at the end of last week rather. But just an embarrassment of riches, and really, really hard to know. I mean, when you look at the Belgian team, we'll hear from Tim de Klerk in a moment, but they've got an obvious leader, Wout van Aert. You know, again, a very strong team, but a very kind of clear focus, if you like. And that might just be an easier plan to make for them. Well, we'll hear from Tim de Klerk now. I mean, obviously the El Tractor, we see him on the front for his team, the Kinnick Quickstep, so much of the year. And here in Flanders, he will be riding in a similar role, but for a different rider.
I guess this is the man here in the red, yellow and black jersey that you'll be working for at the World.
Yep, it's it's not a guy from my team, but yeah, I think I can almost say he's a friend, so he's a colleague I get along really well with, so that's also going to be more easy to turn the button and to ride for him for one day.
You've been a professional a long time, but have you ridden the World Championships at home?
No, never. It's only one time every 20 years, I think, so it's nice to grab that opportunity and to ride in my own country.
It's going to be pretty special, isn't it, I guess? I mean, what do you know about the course at the moment? Have you had a good look at it?
I've looked at it already on the profile. I need to do a recon still, but I know it's going to be a race between the hippies of Scherens in Leuven and a race like Overijse, or Brabantse Pijl. It's going to be a thing between those two races. So it's going to be exciting for sure.
And lastly, I mean, it's a special jersey, isn't it? The Belgian national team jersey, the light blue with the bands of colour. I mean, is it as iconic in Belgium as we feel it is from, you know, outside of Belgium?
Absolutely. I think it's, Belgium is still one of the really countries where cycling lives. So if you can represent that nation in such a beautiful jersey, it's always something really special. So yeah, that gives some extra motivation.
And maybe replace it with a version of the rainbow jersey if you manage to help Wout van Aert win the title.
Yeah, that would be really, really nice. But no, of course it's a bit two different races. Normally you're always there for the Koenig Quickstep, who also pays you, so that's normal, but that for one race in the year, we change it, of course.
It's very much a home race for Tim de Klerk, isn't it, Rich? Because the race finishes in Leuven, which is de Klerk's well, it's the town where he was born. So not just a Flandrian home race, but a hometown race for Tim de Klerk. It does interest me how the Belgians will ensure that they keep Wout van Aert in contention. I mean, Wout van Aert's capable of keeping himself in contention, of course, but, you know, how do they play the Remco Evenepoel card? Do they put him in some kind of move early on and put the pressure on other teams? It's going to be really interesting to see what they do, knowing that Wout van Aert, I mean, you have to think, is the outstanding favourite for the race. I can't, you know, if you had to rank people prior to the start, Van Aert is the number one, isn't he?
I think so. I'll tell you who isn't, in my view, is Tadej Pogacar. I saw him at the finish yesterday, and he stopped briefly to speak, and it's strange. He did not have the air of a two-time Tour de France winner about him, it has to be said. I mean, it's kind of, seeing him out of context like that was a bit strange, in his Slovenian kit, without the usual entourage around him, and having just done a quite a disappointing ride in the time trial for him, as he said. And I think he's feeling the fatigue a bit at this stage of the season, doesn't seem to be at his best, and is probably not one of the favourites for Sunday's road race. It's worth mentioning the British team, isn't it? I mean, they've got a very strong lineup as well. I mean, Ethan Hayt has been on great form recently. Tom Pidcock, who knows what kind of form he's going to be in, but they've got a couple of fast finishers, Mark Cavendish, Jake Stewart as well, Fred Wright, a very strong team indeed that they're putting in the race, and could well have something to say. Cesare Benedetti, who we had on the podcast during the Vuelta, was an Italian, now a Pole, and he's riding for Poland, having just recently switched nationality. He's riding for Poland in these World Championships, and I imagine that will be a pretty special occasion for him.
Interesting. Big money transfer to Poland. Well, you'll be there, won't you, Rich, over the weekend, watching the road races, and we'll be reconvening next week, I'm sure.
Yes, I will. I'll be here. I'm heading home tonight and back on Thursday, and I'm putting together over the course of this week a kind of an updated and improved version of Lionel of Flanders. Not over five parts this time, but something a bit different. I mean, you did your Lionel of Flanders series in 2017, and this feels like quite an important time for cycling in Flanders, not least because the last couple of editions of the Tour of Flanders have been behind closed doors, and there's really a sense here that the fans are returning to cycling. And I think here in Flanders, more than anywhere else in the world, cycling is a spectator sport. You know, a lot of the fans are not cyclists. They are fans of cycling, and that doesn't really happen to the same extent, I don't think, anywhere else. So the fans by the roadside have always been a big and important ingredient of bike racing here in Flanders. That's coming back this week, and I'm going to be speaking to people, the fans, the people who run Flanders Classics, some of the riders, some of the people who run teams here, etc., to get to take the temperature, I suppose, of cycling in Flanders in 2021.
And you're doing a bit of riding.
So looking forward to that as well.
Doing a bit of riding as well.
Doing a bit of riding. I did a ride this morning, and I'll be back with my bike on Thursday to take part in an official event organised by the organisers here on Thursday, over 100 kilometres, riding all the climbs of the World Championship road races. So that will give me a cracking insight into exactly what the riders will be confronting at the weekend.
You'll be almost fit enough to join Lance Armstrong on one of his tours in Mallorca. Just £30,000, I think. Just £30,000 for a place.
Well, if you'd like to sign up as a friend of the podcast, go to thecyclingpodcast.com. No, we promise none of your money will go joining Lance Armstrong on a cycling holiday in Mallorca.
I understand that the former Wimbledon tennis champion, Richard Krajicek, the big serving Dutchman who won, I think, in 1996, has, whether he's paid or whether he's going along as a guest, I don't know, but apparently he's going to be riding with Lance Armstrong in Mallorca at some point next month.
This big serving Scotsman will not be joining him. I like big servings, so that kind of works. for me as well. Well, Lionel, listen, I better go and turn my attention to the women's time trial. Before we go this week, though, we return to the very sad and tragic news of the death of Chris Anker Sørensen. We said that we wanted to hear really from Brian Nygaard, who is a Dane and worked with Chris Anker Sørensen for many years and considered him a very good friend. So we thought we should catch up with Brian and hear about Chris Anker Sørensen from somebody who knew him very well.
Well, Brian, terrible news for Danish cycling as a whole over the weekend with the death of Chris Anker Sørensen. Tell me, how did you know him?
I got to know him when the team I worked for at the time considered taking him in as a neo-professional at the time. And that was, I think the team was still called CSC at the time, or maybe it was already Saxo Bank, I can't remember. But he was obviously a rider that you could see physically, because he was a very, very skinny guy, and Denmark historically doesn't produce that many climbers. So we could tell that he was someone that had obvious qualities. But I remember that I think we were sort of specifically looking at him at the Tour of Denmark, which actually has one quite hilly stage, the one that Evenepoel won this year. But Chris was so nervous that he actually didn't ride that well that day. But Bjarne was quite convinced that he had the goods, and he was obviously a really smart guy. At the time, he was studying biology at university, and he was really sort of not sort of the typical bike rider in his mental outfit. So it was, yeah, Bjarne was really keen on taking him on, and then became quite obvious that he had, I think, even significantly better qualities as a bike rider than most people were aware of, because, you know, when you mainly ride in Denmark, if you're a good climber, you can say the same happened for Vingegaard. It wasn't actually until he started racing outside of Denmark, where the hillier races were many and plenty and really difficult, that we saw what Chris was capable of. He was a very hard worker. What made him a good bike rider was his dedication. He worked extremely hard for what he achieved, and we all know about his results on the bike. He was a really valued domestique for his captains, but he also was able to win quite a few important races and for himself.
And he was with the team CSC for a long time, wasn't he? So although not a prolific winner in the Grand Tours, always a figure in the mountain stages. He won one stage of the Giro, didn't he, in 2010, but a very aggressive rider in mountain stages.
Yeah, really a rider who wasn't afraid taking chances and trying to, like, you know, if it was just a case of pure selection on a mountain stage in the GC, he probably could finish, you know, among the 20 best climbers. But the victories that he won because he showed initiative and took it on to really ride aggressively and go in a breakaway. That's how he took his big stages. And I remember the one in the Giro, because I was at the top of Terminillo myself. And it's sort of the thing in cycling, which is a wonderful thing, that, you know, you change teams, but the friends you have are scattered all over all kinds of teams and geographical places. And I knew Chris really well because he was living in Lucca at the time, and so was I. That just meant that you were bound to travel to the same destinations. And even if I wasn't on the same team as him anymore, we always kept in contact. And on the few rare occasions that I rode my bike, I would see at least one other Danish rider, and it would often be Chris.
And what was he like as a person?
Yeah, you can probably hear me sighing, because that's the hardest part to talk about when young life gets torn away from you, and when you know that he's a father, and you're a father yourself, Lionel, and so am I. There's just aspects to this that are unbearable, and he was first and foremost a father and a family man, in my opinion. Because I've seen him in very different work situations, both as a bike rider, but also I think we probably did commentating. I think I've done 500 hours of live commentating with Chris, and that also meant traveling a lot, you know, at the tour. And it sounds like a really easy job to be a TV commentator, but it's actually not. It requires a lot of preparation. And Chris was just able to do all those things, and then he had so much energy and time left to really talk to his daughters every day, talk to his wife. And one thing I think that distinguishes Chris especially was that he had the ability to never, ever make his own problems anyone else's burden, but he was always the first to help other people if they had any. He just brought happiness, you know. He was, wherever he went, he was just always really, always in good spirits, always in a good mood. And that, I think that's one of the reasons why he was also such a good commentator. He was really always very enthusiastic about the races, always, you know, had a great sense of humor. It was very entertaining commentating with him. And I think the spectators or the TV spectators had the same feeling. And I remember saying to Rasmus Stehøj, who, you know, we did the commentating together, the three of us, that we can never complain, because sometimes Chris, I mean, the first year we did the tour, Chris was still a professional bike rider and he rode every morning, other than, you know, sadly, that's also how he left us, by doing recon. It was very important to him that he knew as much as possible about the parkour that he was commentating on. But he was still a professional bike rider. So I think he rode around 3,000 kilometers that tour, and he did a lot of the full stage commentating, which is often 5-6 hours. Then the post studio where we were available as well. And we were so tired, but Chris never complained. that was just how he was. He was just naturally really, really tuned into what he cared about in life, and it was impossible not to feel that if you were close to him.
And lastly, I mean, how has this news been taken in Danish cycling and I guess Danish sport as a wider thing? I mean, how will Chris Anker Sørensen be remembered?
Chris was a really well-known figure in Denmark. You know, it's probably obvious to everyone that cycling is a huge sport and has grown immensely in Denmark. And I think also thanks to the way that Chris has been able to educate. You don't educate your spectators, but I think you inspire them to be curious to understand more about the sport. And Chris was certainly probably the best at that ever in Danish cycling commentary. But he was also someone that people really liked. You know, he was just a very, very popular person. And it's just an incredible loss when someone at that age, just in the blink of an eye, just disappears. A part of life seems like it stops and you don't really know how to start it again, because it doesn't feel like it can go on in the same way when someone really important is missing. And I think that's often the feeling we have when we lose someone, especially when we lose someone that we care about, but also when it just happens in such a horrible way and obviously very unexpected. So it's a huge loss. And I think the mourning across other sports as well, and in general, you know, it's everyone from the prime minister to all the people who loved what he did for TV who are really sad these days. It's really hard for me to think about how, you know, I lost a friend and I lost a colleague and someone that I'll never forget. But someone lost their father and someone lost their husband. Someone lost their son and, you know, someone lost someone that was dear to them in a completely different way that when you have family yourself, you really understand the severity of Chris not being here.